And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, listeners, from your delinquently genial host, John Derbyshire, back at the home studio in Long Island after last weekend's sortie into Middle Tennessee for the American Renaissance Conference. Concerning which, I must apologise for my delinquency. I posted a brief pre-conference podcast on Friday the 20th, with the stated intention to add a post-conference summary on Monday 23rd. However, arriving home on Monday evening after 960 miles on the road, I was too pooped to podcast. The hungry sheep looked up and were not fed, for which I offer abject apologies. Let me therefore start off this week's Radio Derb with some retrospective notes on the conference. The American Renaissance Conference was a great success, fizzing with energy and optimism. This is the fourth conference I've attended, and it was far and away the most memorable. For one thing, there were the sheer numbers of people attending, a 70% increase over last year. The venue was Montgomery Bell State Park in Tennessee. The park itself is lovely, and in the middle of it there's a conference centre with meeting rooms, a restaurant, and 120 guest rooms, plus several cabins. Those accommodations were nothing like enough for the number of attendees, and people who registered late for the conference had to stay in motels outside the park. I told Jared Taylor if his numbers go on increasing like this, 5 years from now he'll have to rent Yankee Stadium. And then there was the number of young people attending. At events like this, you get the regulars who show up every year, and you get some new faces. The new faces this year in Tennessee looked to me to have a median age around 30. Yes, listeners, the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans. To us of the older cohort of alt-right subversives, that happy thought comes with a small dark shadow attached. As younger Americans flock to the cause, we geezers have to move to the back of the wagon and let them take the reins. But then, that reflection itself comes with a counter-reflection. It's the energy and vitality of youth that drives events forwards. But, as well as being exuberant and ingenious, youth is often reckless and silly. It needs tempering with some quiet words of sense and moderation from the elders of the tribe. Not too much tempering, but a little at key junctures. Si jeunesse savait, si vieillesse pouvait. So the world turns. One good thing about being part of a conservative insurgency is that the younger insurgents are respectful of the tribal elders. Jared Taylor, the only begetter of American Renaissance, who's been doggedly ploughing the white advocacy furrow for a quarter of a century now, in the teeth of all kinds of difficulties and obstacles, Jared was received as a hero by the conference attendees last weekend, with a long-standing ovation for his Saturday afternoon speech. Likewise, Sam Dixon, who traditionally gives that last address of the conference on Sunday morning. Thanks to both of them, and to Jared's staff for making it all happen. The other striking feature of this year's AMREN conference, other than its youthfulness, was its international flavour. There were 10 speakers. Subtracting out Jared's address and Sam Dixon's traditional benediction, the other 8 speakers broke out by nationality as a Mexican, a South African, an Estonian, 2 Belgians, and 3 Americans. Yes, you heard that right. We had a Mexican speaker, Fernando Cortes, a Mexican nationalist. Mexicans, he told us, like most people everywhere, would rather stay in their own country, in a familiar place with a familiar culture. But the crooks in charge of Mexico run the place for their own enrichment, using emigration to the USA as a safety valve so that discontented poor Mexicans don't become too much of a menace to them. Our own elites are happy to help them keep the racket going. Those crooks have so messed up the Mexican economy, Mr. Cortes told us, that the country is now a net importer of beans. That sounds to me like a real crisis. Whatever you think of his main thesis, Mr. Cortes is surely right that Mexico and the US are stuck with each other as neighbours. The best way to manage that relationship is the same way we cope with the family in the house next door. With good manners and consideration, respect for each other's privacy and property, mutual help in emergencies, and good stout fences. Both of the speakers from Belgium were elected politicians. Philip de Winter, a member of the European Parliament, and Anke van der Meersch, a member of Belgium's Senate. At present, even with the upsurge in interest and enthusiasm already noted, at present Jared Taylor can still only dream of getting elected American politicians to speak at his conference. In Europe, though, the great conflict of our age, the conflict between nationalism and globalism, is much more acute. It's especially acute in Belgium. For one thing, there are 2 nationalities in Belgium, Dutch speakers and French speakers, in a 60-40 ratio, with Dutch speakers mostly in the north and French speakers in the south. It would make sense for the place to be administered as 2 separate countries. The Dutch speakers are keenest on this. They have a political party, Vlaams Belang, to which both of the AMREN speakers belong. For another thing, Belgium has been afflicted with massive Muslim immigration. The capital city, Brussels, is 1/4 Muslim. We saw the consequences in the airport and subway attacks of March 22nd, when Muslim terrorists killed 32 people in Brussels. Belgium is thus the cockpit of the struggle for national identity in Europe, and it wasn't surprising to see 2 speakers from that small country addressing the conference. The South African speaker, Dan Root, is of course an Afrikaner. The language of the Afrikaners is Afrikaans, closely related to Dutch, and so only a bit less closely to English. You can sort of make sense of Afrikaans when you see it on the page. Mr. Root told us about a book written by a colleague of his with the title Afrikaners zien Canaries in der Kolenmijn, which translates as, yes, Afrikaners are canaries in the coal mine. You might think that white South Africa is a lost cause. Mr. Root allowed that, indeed, it may be the first European nation to go extinct. On the other hand, he offered some alternative possibilities. The place might fall apart, giving white South Africans the chance to carve out some territories of their own. Or, rather surprisingly, Mr. Root said that South Africa may end up being dominated by China or India. The Estonian guy, Ruben Kaalep, was the youngest speaker ever to address an AMREN conference, just 22 years old. He spoke in the high diction of romantic nationalism, mystic chords of memory, and so on. But there was some prose in among the poetry. Sample, quote, "You can only have tolerance and friendly relations when you have homelands." End quote. Well, AMREN will put all their conference proceedings up on the internet, though it takes a while, and I leave you to explore them for yourselves. It was a great weekend, and we all enjoyed ourselves. If you're interested in national question issues and can spare a weekend next spring, sign up for the American Renaissance Conference. I'll see you there. Staying on that European theme for a while, there have been some developments over there worth noting. The most newsworthy one was in Austria, where there's a presidential election every 6 years on a straight popular vote. They just had that election. The winner was a chap named Alexander van der Bellen, who ran as an independent. That was surprising enough in itself, as political power in Austria tends to belong to one or other of the two biggest parties, one centre-right and the other centre-left. In this presidential election, both of those parties were eliminated in the first round of voting a month ago. The centre-left placed fourth, the centre-right placed fifth. The two leading candidates went to a runoff election, and that's the one we had last week. The winner, and so the new president, ran as an independent, but in practice he's a left liberal environmentalist. Austria's a very pretty country. Think mountains, lakes, Edelweiss, Lederhosen, and so on. Naturally, environmentalism is strong there. As I said, it's surprising enough by itself for an independent to win the presidency. What's even more surprising is that Mr. van der Bellen won by just a whisker over his runoff opponent, Norbert Hofer, of the Freedom Party. The actual size of the whisker was 0.7%. That's about one vote out of 150. The Freedom Party is the one you see tagged with the epithet far right in the mainstream media. Since they just got 49.7% of the popular vote against Mr. van der Bellen's 50.3%, it seems a bit odd to call them far anything. There were 17 American presidential elections in which the winning candidate got less of the popular vote than did Mr. Hofer. The list includes, for example, Harry Truman in 1948, Bill Clinton in both 92 and 96, Woodrow Wilson in both 1912 and 1916, and, of course, Abraham Lincoln in 1860. Do those presidents get an epithet beginning with the word far? If not, why not? Mr. Hofer's Freedom Party gets called far right because they are national conservatives who want to stop the Third World invasion of their country. The left, of course, will tell you that. No, no, no. It's because among their supporters are fans of the 20th century's most famous Austrian. And I'm not talking about Maria von Trapp. I'm sure they're right. I have worked in politics at the ground level, attending constituency meetings for my local chapter of the Conservative Party back in the Margaret Thatcher years. Let me tell you, in case you don't know, politics at the base level attracts a fair number of lunatics. Most people, however, even most constituency activists, are not lunatics. Should Austria's Freedom Party win the next parliamentary election 2 years from now, Austria will not invade Poland or start erecting gas chambers. Trust me on this. Austria, of course, with no offence to anyone, Austria is not a very important place. What happened there this election, though, is happening all over. The centre-left and centre-right are losing market share. They're losing too, on the one hand, tree-hugging anti-capitalists like Mr. Van der Bellen and Bernie Sanders. There's another politician from a small, pretty, mountainous place. And on the other hand, to secure borders nationalists like Mr. Hofer and Donald Trump. The pattern is unmistakable. Manual workers in Austria went 86% for Mr. Hofer. He only got 40% of white-collar workers. Over to the USA, where analyst Thomas Edsall reported in the New York Times on Wednesday that Mrs. Clinton's support among white men without college degrees is at 14%. That is a simply sensational figure. This is the Democratic Party, remember. The lunch pail party. The party of the little guy. White men without college degrees. 14% for the party's presumptive nominee. That's pretty much a lunatic fringe. 14%. I note in passing, by the way, that Edsall's column that I just quoted from bears the title, How Do You Solve a Problem Like Trump? It looks like Edsall has Austria on his mind too. Here are a couple of footnotes to that last segment. The first footnote concerns Slovakia. That's the eastern bit of what we Cold War survivors recall as Czechoslovakia. Before it was Czechoslovakia, it belonged to the dual monarchy of Austria-Hungary. So we're hanging on by our fingernails to the Austrian theme here. Radio Derb devotees will recall us covering Slovakia back in February as one of the Visegrad Four nations, Poland, Hungary, Czechia, and Slovakia, all of them robustly nationalist. I swooned over Slovakian Prime Minister Robert Fico, saying back then that, quote, we will never make a voluntary decision that would lead to the formation of a unified Muslim community in Slovakia. Multiculturalism is a fiction. End quote. I mentioned that Slovakia had an election coming up in March. They duly had it. Mr. Fico is still Prime Minister, although now as head of a four-party coalition. He's still nationalist, too. Thursday this week, in an interview with the local newswire service, the Prime Minister said, quote, it may look strange, but sorry, Islam has no place in Slovakia. End quote. The European Union is trying to force quotas of so-called asylum seekers on all the countries of Europe. Prime Minister Fitso is firmly against those quotas. Again, it's a small and inconsequential country, but it's giving a big lesson. Mr. Fitso's party actually is centre-left. It's a social democratic party. He himself was once a communist party member. So here's an alternative for the centre-left and centre-right. Instead of watching your working-class support drain away to nationalists, steal some of the nationalists' clothes. Slovakia actually does have a strongly nationalist party, Marian Kotleba's People's Party. In those March elections, they got 8% of the vote, up from less than 2% last time around. They now have seats in Parliament for the first time ever. That's why centre-left Prime Minister Fitso is stealing their nationalist clothes. It's roughly like Hillary Clinton calling for strict enforcement of our immigration laws, if you can imagine that. Message to the centrist parties on nationalism. If you can't beat them, join them. Second footnote, northward to Germany, a much more consequential country. The new party on the block here is Alternative for Germany, AfD for short. AfD is a national conservative party, and they are racking up double-digit percentages in local elections. Earlier this month, the AfD, at its annual conference, inserted the sentence, "Islam does not belong to Germany," into its official policy platform. That, of course, got the globalists gasping and sputtering. Here, for example, is German pundit Anna Sauerbre sputtering in English for the New York Times, May 26th. Sample quotes. AfD refers to German culture as the Einheimische Kultur, native culture, and describes the German nation as a cultural unit under threat from immigrant cultures. Its programme for the state election in Baden-Württemberg in March stated, "Germany's cultural foundation is being smashed by immigration." It follows, at least for the new German right, that cultures can be compared and ranked. Some are worth preserving, while others are invasive and inferior. German culture is under constant risk of losing its purity, and its defence is a core role of the state. It is a thinly veiled update of the old racist ideologies. Culturism as the new racism. End quotes. You see how far the left has travelled here? Time was, they would scream and sputter at you for saying that some races are better than others. "It's nothing to do with biology," they'd shriek. "It's just culture." Now, they scream and sputter if you say that some cultures are better than others. What people like Ms. Sauerbre seem unable to grasp is that it is possible, in fact it's rather common, to be against mass immigration without holding any opinion at all about whether one culture is better or worse than another. I, for example, am fine with Islam. If people want to be Muslims, that's absolutely okay with me. I don't mind a bit. Jolly good luck to them. There are 50-odd majority Muslim nations where they can live out their lives in Islamic culture. Far as I'm concerned, they're welcome to do so. I wish them joy. We have a saying here on the alt-right. You might want to write it down, so I'll pause while you get a pencil and a piece of paper. Okay, ready? Here's our saying. That's what separate countries are for. If you want to be a Muslim, or a Zoroastrian, or an anarcho-syndicalist, or a blood-drinking headhunter, go ahead. I wouldn't dream of trying to interfere. Just please stay in your own countries and be those things. Leave me in my country to enjoy the culture I grew up in and am familiar with. Modern, Western, not very religious, sexually egalitarian, easygoing, English-speaking, social democratic culture. Is my culture better than yours? Pass. Is Islam a stupid, cruel, and wrong-headed religion? No idea. Does Sharia law entail a shackling, an enslavement of the human spirit? Beats my pair of jacks. Just, please, leave me the heck alone with the culture I know and am happy in. And I'll return the favour. And just one footnote to the footnotes there. I used the phrase asylum seekers a few minutes ago. That young Estonian fellow at the AMREN conference suggested that a more accurate descriptor would be fortune seekers, since that's what most of them are. I second the suggestion. Hero of the Week, John Trandem, who owns a small automobile business near Fargo, North Dakota. Mr. Trandem is a Republican Party activist and one of the 28 delegates North Dakota will be sending to the GOP nominating convention in July. North Dakota doesn't have a primary or caucuses, but it does, of course, have delegates who are officially not bound to any particular candidate unless they publicly declare themselves to be. Well, on Thursday, Mr. Trandem declared his support for Donald Trump. That made him Trump's 1,237th committed delegate, sealing the deal on Trump's nomination. The Donald thanked North Dakota's delegates at a press conference in Bismarck, a town named for another famous person of German extraction. At the same event, Trump agreed to debate Bernie Sanders prior to the June 7th California primary, if a big enough venue could be found at such short notice and a TV outlet willing to donate the broadcast revenues to charity. That, if it comes off, will be, as they say, great television. In fact, Mr. Trump did say that. Quote, "We would have such high ratings," end quote. They sure would. I'll watch that debate for sure, if it comes off. Can you imagine old Bernie croaking, "Get off the lawn," while Trump demands to know the size of his package? There are, of course, some crabbed spirits who disapprove. "This would be a complete circus," honked Democratic strategist Brad Bannon. He further honked, quote, "To me, it shows more than anything else that American politics has become entertainment," end quote. For goodness sake, when was Anglo-Saxon politics not entertainment? Read the election chapter in Pickwick Papers. In case you don't know the text, the name of the parliamentary constituency being fought over is Eat and Swill. Jay Leno said that politics is, quote, show business for ugly people. Donald Trump is actually not an ugly person, but the show business part of Leno's aphorism still applies. Concerning the projected debate, Trump said, quote, we could have a lot of fun. That's a big part of the Trump appeal right there. The guy's obviously enjoying himself. Different Americans want different things from their politicians, but not many of us want to be lectured at by humourless scolds and prune-faced schoolmarms. That brings us to Mrs. Clinton. I'm getting close as I shall ever get, I do believe. I'm getting close to feeling sorry for Hillary. She's a simply terrible campaigner. Trump is just so much better. Peggy Noonan nicely captured Hillary's charmlessness the other week, writing that the Trump show is, quote from Peggy, quote, better than Hillary's grim and horrifying attempts to chuckle like a person who chuckles. End quote. Great line, Peggy. When Trump announced his willingness to debate Bernie Sanders, the sound of Hillary's teeth grinding could be heard coast to coast. Trump is his party's nominee. Hillary is her party's nominee. Shouldn't he be debating her? Well, it was Bernie, not Hillary, who challenged Trump to debate, and Hillary seems to have backed out from debating Bernie. Great strategizing, Hillary. Hillary's reticence is even dumber than it looks, as she's polling way ahead of Trump in California, 50% to 40%. Bernie polls even better than she does, 53% to Trump's 36%. So not only does the lady have nothing to lose here, she has something to win. It can only be that Mrs. Clinton knows what a lousy candidate she is. Figures she'll get the nomination anyway on support from minorities and public sector unions, and intends to just run out the clock. Regardless, that Democratic honker got it right. This is great entertainment. I can't remember when I've enjoyed politics so much. The national appetite for stories, for books and movies, about white people being beastly to black people is apparently insatiable. A blockbuster of this genre was the novel and TV movie Roots, back in the 1970s. The book, written by professional black guy Alex Haley, was published in 1976. The TV show aired in 1977. There was great enthusiasm at the time about both book and miniseries. I'll confess, I was caught up in that enthusiasm. I hadn't been in the USA very long. I hadn't shaken off my youthful naivety about race. And look, it was 1977, 40 years closer to Jim Crow than we are today. All right, I'm making excuses. Confession is good for the soul, though. I fell for the whole thing, including the flat doodle about it being the result of Haley's researches into his family history. In fact, he made most of it up out of whole cloth. Now, 40 years on, You'd think that the vein of white guilt had been thoroughly worked out. Well, here's a bunch of people betting it hasn't. A&E Networks, a media conglomerate that owns a bunch of TV and cable channels, has spent $50 million on a remake of Roots. Not just a straight remake either. Hollywood Reporter tells us that it is, quote, a more violent and more accurate remake. I'm certainly willing to believe it's more violent, given how TV standards have loosened up since 1977, but I'm not sure what more accurate means. It can't mean historically accurate, since the thing was fiction anyway. Perhaps it means closer to the book, in which case the right adjective would be faithful. This is Hollywood Reporter, though, so I guess we shouldn't ask for literacy. Hollywood Reporter was reporting on a day-long event at the White House for the cast and producers of the 8-hour epic. The event included a screening. Surely not of all 8 hours. It's not clear. A screening and a panel discussion. This whole thing was hosted by Valerie Jarrett, President Obama's closest advisor and a leading light, if you'll pardon the pun, a leading light of America's mulatto elite. This was ahead of the movie being aired on Memorial Day, simultaneously on the History Channel, Lifetime and A&E. Along with these all-day airings, the show will also be transmitted to smartphones everywhere, shown as a feature in America's 17 remaining cinemas, made compulsory viewing in all the nation's schools and colleges, and projected onto the surface of the moon. Okay, I made some of that up. But media-wise, this is a very big deal. LeVar Burton starred in the original TV miniseries back in 1977 as the young Kunta Kinte, a West African lad who was living an idyllic life in his peaceful village among nurturing women, dignified hunters and wise elders, when he was kidnapped by coarse, brutish white men and taken to British North America as a slave. Let me repeat, please, I am really ashamed that I fell for this stuff. 18th century white slavers didn't venture further into West Africa than they had to, because A, they were terrified of the diseases, and B, they didn't need to, Africans being only too willing to sell their own people for a bag of glass beads. Why wouldn't they be? Slavery was the norm in Africa. In parts of Africa, it still is. A 2012 report from CNN says that 10 to 20% of the population of Mauritania lives in slavery. I wonder if that got a White House screening. My guess would be not. And perhaps this, quote, more accurate remake of Roots shows the true state of affairs in 18th century West Africa. Again, I'm guessing not. But really, why a remake? One reason seems to be that the white people in the original weren't evil enough. Quote from Hollywood Reporter, quote, "The original Roots has its deficiencies. It hasn't aged well at all. At times it's overly sentimental and historically dubious. A handful of white characters diverge seriously from Haley's novel, most conspicuously a benevolent slave ship captain played by Ed Asner. And the white actors, though their roles were peripheral, were prominent in the network promos. End quote. A benevolent slave ship captain. White actors prominent. Plainly, that 1977 original was hijacked by white supremacists. Hollywood Reporter quotes black guy Thomas Carter, one of the movie's four, count them, four directors, quote, "Many black people don't know the details of some of this history because we don't teach it in general. We know that there was slavery, but the particulars of the brutality of American slavery, the destruction of family, the dehumanization, things that have continued to affect us, we just don't even talk about it." End quote. Excuse me? You don't talk about it? My rather strong impression is, you talk about little else. It's possible you were talking about the Peloponnesian War, or cytoplasmic determinants, or the heat death of the universe, or Fermat's Last Theorem, when I wasn't paying attention. But all I ever hear black showbiz types talk about is what a rotten deal it is to be black in America, and how cruel and racist white people are. Hollywood Reporter goes on to tell us that, quote, "That is beginning to change. Social media, the exposure of police brutality, overwhelmingly lopsided incarceration rates among minorities, and the willingness of Hollywood to embark on projects like Roots is advancing the racial justice dialogue." End quote. Ah, that dialogue. When you hear that phrase, racial justice dialogue, you know the shakedown artists can't be far behind. Sure enough, here comes the Reverend Dr. Al Sharpton, Jr. the Third, Esquire, or however the hell the old charlatan styles himself nowadays. Quote, "I will be talking it up," says Sharpton. "If we can create the conversation, Roots will not only get a wide viewership, it will evolve the discussions about race, hopefully from yelling at each other to really talking about the pain and what we're going to do in the post-Obama era." End quote. Well, here's a suggestion for something you might do, Reverend Dr. Al. You might pay your taxes like an honest citizen. It can't be just me, can it? Please tell me it's not just me that wants to take to the hills with camping gear and a year's supply of food, ammo and reading matter any time I hear someone talk about advancing the racial justice dialogue or evolving the discussions about race. It's not just me, is it? And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Just a shout-out here to one of the best bloggers in the business, Daniel Greenfield. He runs a blog named Sultan Knish. That's a damn stupid name, if anybody wants my opinion. But nothing else about the blog is stupid. May 16th, Greenfield ran a post about Mickey Fearn, the affirmative action hire in charge of communications and community assistance for the National Park Service. Mr. Fearn has figured out why black people don't patronise our national parks much. It's the trees. Blacks, you see, associate trees with slaves being lynched by their masters. That's Mr. Fearn's theory. Or not precisely his, as Greenfield shows. There's a whole mob of academics celebrities, judges, and activists pushing this stuff. Never mind that no rational slave owner would destroy an item of valuable property without a very good reason. And never mind that the Tuskegee Institute logged 4 years in which more whites were lynched than blacks. Never mind any of that. There are jobs and money at stake here. Ask Reverend Al. Someone in that activist mob has further claimed that national parks alienate Latinos too, because park ranger uniforms look too much like the Border Patrol. I think the activists are missing a couple of tricks here. Chinese Americans don't go to national parks because the shapes of the hills remind them of coolie hats. Homosexuals don't go into the woods because it would remind them of the butt rape scene in Deliverance. Transgender people... Oh, give me time. I'll come up with something. Item. In another excellent column last Sunday, Greenfield took on the narrative, which you hear a lot now, that moderate Muslims are, to quote Barack Obama, our most important partners in the fight against violent extremism. And that restricting Muslim immigration would turn all our moderate Muslims into extremists. Over to Greenfield, longish quote. Even if Muslim communities were an asset, this narrative is that they benefit us by helping us deal with the problems that they cause. The obvious question would be to wonder why we need them in the first place, to help us cope with a problem that wouldn't exist without them. Obama insists that we need Muslim immigration so that Muslims will help us fight Muslim terror. But if we didn't have Muslim immigration, we wouldn't need Muslims to help us fight Muslim terrorism. Muslim immigration isn't a solution. It's a problem posing as a solution. And we are told that we need to make the problem bigger in order to solve it. End quote. That's Daniel Greenfield blogging at Sultan Knish. Check him out. Item. I was reading this article in Monday's Guardian by some bird named Mona Chalabi. Title. Say my name, say my name. Why the correct pronunciation is whatever I decide. Apparently, Miss Chalabi's Arabic-speaking parents pronounce her name Muna. She herself prefers Mona. Quote, if I use the Arabic pronunciation, I'm staying true to my roots and being authentic. If I suggest an English-sounding variant, I'm trying hard to assimilate in an English-speaking society. End quote. She goes for Mona to show that she's assimilated. My first thought there was, good for you, honey. My second thought was, why the hell am I reading this? The answer to that is that I had just got back from the AMREN conference, and as always in big gatherings like that, I had fielded approximately 80 queries about how I pronounce my name. Please don't think I'm complaining. People are just trying to be polite, I know, and I appreciate the courtesy. It's just that I don't care how people say it, within fairly wide bounds of approximation. Furthermore, I can never remember how other people like their names pronounced. The author of The Righteous Mind, for example, who I've actually met a couple of times. Is he Jonathan Haidt or Jonathan Haidt? So I'm forgiving towards alternate pronunciations of my name. I say Derbyshire. I've heard my American kids say Derbyshire, though. If it's good enough for them, it's good enough for anyone. Just do your best with it. I don't mind. Item, finally, an erratum. In my May 13th podcast, I reported on the economist who aroused the suspicions of airport security by sitting in his seat on the plane doodling differential equations. They thought it was terrorist code, and they questioned him. I wondered aloud whether those were ordinary differential equations or partial differential equations. Then I sneered that, quote, "My guess is that they were ODEs. An economist wouldn't be smart enough to handle PDEs." Well, sneer not, lest ye be sneered. A friend asked, "What about the Black-Scholes equation for pricing stock options?" I struggled to recall details of the Black-Scholes equation. "I thought it was an ODE," I said. "No," my friend said firmly, "it was a PDE." Back home, I looked up the derivation of Black-Scholes in the appendix of George Spiro's excellent book, Pricing the Future. Yes, damn it, it uses PDEs. Serves me right for sneering, I suppose. Although, wait, does financial engineering really count as a branch of economics? Eh? Ha! That's it, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening, and I wish you a peaceful and reflective Memorial Day, preferably not dominated by the 8-hour remake of Roots. Try not to look up at the moon. I'm still excited from the success of last weekend's conference, capped by Donald Trump's delegate count going over the top. The sun is shining, the birds are singing, and life is good. Here's Gracie to sing us out in appropriately upbeat style. More from Radio Derb next week.